welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin McGordy, member of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your co-chair for today. It is our pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new members who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off your cell phones and other devices. Now, there are some other upcoming Science and Technology Member-Led Forum events I would like to tell you about. On Tuesday, October 28th, Stanley Prusiner will present a program based on his new book, Madness and Memory. On Tuesday, November 4th, Heather Gold will discuss empowering communities and gigabytes to the home. These are just two of the many upcoming programs, and we invite you to check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org are calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. And now we'll begin today's program.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your co-chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Kevin Rowe. Kevin Rowe is a patent attorney in Silicon Valley and was formerly an electrical engineer specializing in computers and integrated circuits at companies such as IBM and Xerox PARC. Kevin has written several patent applications for robotics and artificial intelligence for all environments, including very high radiation environments. Please join me in welcoming Kevin Rowe.
Again, I'd like to say thank you to Kevin and to Chisako, for the introduction. I put two quotes here. I think these are incredibly appropriate. One is from Euripides. He was the greatest of the Greek playwrights. He lived about 400 BC. This is one of the most intelligent sentences anyone ever wrote in history. A man's most valuable trait is a judicious sense of what not to believe. Edmund Burke was an 18th century English politician, and he wrote another thing which I thought was incredibly appropriate. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And if you think back on your life and all the things you've seen in your life, you'll see the truth of those two quotes. Since I'm under incredible time limitation during this talk, I'm going to have to cover an enormous amount of material very quickly. Some of you know a great deal about radiation already, some of you don't. I'll try and get you all up to speed as fast as I can. I won't be able to go into great detail on robotics because there's so many other issues that have to be handled first. I have to summarize the situation, explain the radiation levels in the buildings, what radiation can do to humans and electronics. Since most of the information about Fukushima has been suppressed, I'm going to have to talk about Chernobyl because Chernobyl is much better understood as to what happened. I'll discuss conventional technology, and I'll propose a solution, and I'll give you more information. If I was just to get up here and tell you that we need to develop a new robotic technology 1,000 times better than what we have today at a cost of tens of billions of dollars, you would laugh me out of the room. And you'd say, good luck, pal, that's never going to happen. Nobody's going to spend tens of billions of dollars developing new robotic technology 1,000 times greater than what we have today. But if I explain to you what the situation really is and how bad it really is and how bad it's going to get, then you'll understand why you have to spend the money for this. So let's get on with it. radiation that you'll see, becquerel, is one radioactive disintegration per second. It could be the emission of a beta particle, an electron, an alpha particle, which is a helium nucleus of two protons and two neutrons, or a gamma ray or a neutron. Some atom isotopes have too many neutrons in the nucleus. They're unstable, and they become stable by emitting beta particles normally and converting the neutrons into protons, and that makes the atom more stable. Another measurement that's used that goes back to Madame Curie, and it's roughly about a gram of radium, 226, puts out 3.7 times 10 to the 10th power disintegrations per second, which is an enormous amount of radiation. And that's also one of the reasons why Madame Curie died of radiation. I think her husband would have died from radiation too if he hadn't been killed by an accident earlier. But these are important concepts, especially the becquerel. So one radioactive disintegration per second. As you all know, Fukushima has at least three reactor meltdowns. It took Tokyo Electric Power Company, I think, about 6 months to admit that there finally was total meltdowns at those reactor sites. Up until then, they were trying to downplay it and say, don't worry, be happy. We've got it all under control. Everything's fine. Go back shopping at the shopping malls and don't worry about it. We'll take care of this. And then after about 6 months, they went, oh, yeah, by the way, they all melted down, melted. An enormous amount of radiation was released, but 80% of it went over to the Pacific Ocean, so it's not too bad. Japan only got 20% of a huge amount of radiation. At any rate, one of the government workers put out an estimate, which was repeated by the news media in some places, that about 30 billion becquerels of radioactive cesium and another 30 billion becquerels of radioactive strontium are leaking into the ocean every single day. And the best wild guess estimates are that somewhere between 400 to 1,000 tons of ocean water, or actually groundwater, are leaking into the ocean every day. But nobody really knows for sure how much water is really coming out. These are guesstimates. I don't see any way how they could accurately measure how much groundwater is going through those reactor cores. As far as the 30 billion becquerels estimates, I think that is really an underestimate. The Japanese Times, one of the newspapers in Japan, put out an article saying that they measured 2.35 billion becquerels per liter of water of cesium, cesium-137, 134, and 750 million becquerels of strontium, like strontium-90, which is the most dangerous of all the beta emitters that I know of. Cesium is actually, to be precise, cesium-137 is a beta emitter as well, but it has a radioactive disintegration to metastable barium and immediately emits a powerful gamma ray. So cesium-137 is theoretically a beta emitter, but in reality it's a gamma emitter as well, because the metastable barium emits the gamma within a matter of hours. Radiation effects. There's two kinds of ways to look at radiation. One is to just look at it from an energy absorption viewpoint and talk about it in terms of rads and grays. A gray is 100 rads, and it's a certain amount of energy absorbed per unit volume of matter. And then there's another measurement called REMS, and these are radiation equivalent biological damage measurement parameters, where a REM or a sievert corresponds to actual biological damage as measured by radiation. And for X-rays and gamma rays, one rad equals one REM, so it's easy. gamma rays are far higher frequency than X-rays, far more damaging to your DNA. But X-rays and gamma rays, and also beta particles, also are considered to be essentially one rad equals one rem. Neutrons are more dangerous. That's why governments were developing neutron bombs decades ago. Neutrons are incredibly devastating to human bodies. They go through steel very quickly, so they're the excellent anti-tank weapon to use to explode a neutron bomb and wipe out an invasion of tanks. You cook all the tank operators immediately, and they die from the neutrons. Alpha particles are the worst of all. Alpha particles, the two protons and two neutrons together is an alpha particle. If that hits your tissue, that does 20 times more damage than an X-ray. So that's 20 rems equals one rad. One rad equals 20 rems. So alpha particles are the worst of all. The good news about alpha particles are the absorption is only, well, actually the air distance that are alpha particle travel in air is like 1 to 2 inches. But if you actually eat food or get something in your lungs that emits alpha particles, it's incredibly devastating to your tissue. It's like a 16-inch cannon shell hitting your DNA. The neutrons also are bad, but less so. It depends on their energy level. The average neutron, they would say one rad equals 20 rems, or 10 rems. 10 rems for one rad of neutrons. So these are important parameters to keep in mind. For humans, the reason why humans can't go into the reactors is the radiation inside those reactors is absolutely unbelievably high. It's almost incomprehensible. The radiation is so incredible that you would be fried. You'd get a lethal dose within seconds in many cases, depending on how close you actually get to the core itself, to one of the cores. The threshold for vomiting is like 100 rems. If you get 100 rems of radiation, you start vomiting. And there's something the news media hasn't been telling you about, and that is the fact that there was a lot of U.S. sailors in Operation Tomodachi. You remember after the earthquake, the United States sent in about 100,000 sailors in ships and the USS Ronald Reagan to go over and help out the Japanese under Operation Tomodachi. Several hundred of those sailors are showing all the classic signs of radiation sickness. They were vomiting and suffering severe diarrhea in the ships at the time, even when they were offshore off the coast of Japan. And there's several hundred of them that are now involved in a lawsuit that doesn't have much hope, but they're trying to sue for compensation from the Japanese government and TEPCO. They probably won't succeed, but one of them has already died from the radiation. What they're dying from is typically leukemia or lymphoma. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, chronic and acute leukemias, things like that. 150 rem is the bare minimum to kill a human. If that would be a very weak human, perhaps a child or an old person. 320 rem to 360 rem is enough to kill a human within 60 days. Typically, 50, that's like an LD50, where 50% of people would die within 60 days if they got exposed to that much radiation. And then, even if you do get medical treatment, 480 rem is enough to pretty much cook your goose. You've got a 50% chance of dying within 60 days from if you get 480 rems. That is even if you get some medical support, like transfusions and so forth. The Fukushima Daiichi molten cores, each of them about 120 tons each, would have much higher levels. They sent in some robots. Some of the robots never came back out. The radiation cooked them pretty well. one of the robots was able to go in close enough to measure 73 sieverts per hour, which is the equivalent of 7,300 rems per hour, which tells you how long you would last if you were to get that close. So humans are not going to be going into those reactor cores, getting near those reactor cores for many, many decades, because the radiation is just incredibly devastating. And some people have said, well, why don't you recruit suicide squads to go in there and just take care of it, you know, rotate them out every few seconds and so forth. Well, who's going to volunteer for a job like that? I mean, to die from radiation is a horrible way to die. It is a horrible, horrible way to die. So that's why robots are necessary. So the question is, how does radiation kill robots and electronics? Well, one way is, whether it's bipolar transistor circuits or whether it's MOSFET field effect transistor circuits, if you have a large radiation environment, that creates leakage currents. The transistors become extremely leaky. They become like a great big resistor. So you swamp out the logic signals in a sea of leakage currents. So this is one way that high radiation kills electronics, regardless of what it is. So that's one way. So the question is, what kind of radiation resistance would electronics for a robot need to resist? Back in 1986, the Soviet Union had a reactor meltdown that essentially bankrupted and destroyed the Soviet Union at Chernobyl. Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union, said that the Chernobyl meltdown created so much economic damage to the Soviet Union that that was what actually destroyed the Soviet Union. It wasn't Reagan's Star Wars projects. It was actually the enormous cost in many different ways of the Chernobyl meltdown that destroyed the Soviet Union. So that's something to remember about reactor meltdowns. One reactor meltdown is enough to destroy a country economically, politically, socially. But the Chernobyl meltdown in 1986 produced some very interesting effects. And one of them was called the elephant's foot. How many of you have ever heard of the elephant's foot? Only a few? So under Chernobyl, after the reactor completely burned up and melted down, the Russians went in there and dumped millions of tons of sand and lead and boron to try to suppress the reactor core. And a lot of that flowed out through the bottom pipes into the basement areas. And in one place, it produced a big solid lump of molten core that was called the elephant's foot. And actually, it was only about 10% molten core and about 90% sand and lead and other things. But the radiation level, even for the elephant's foot, was over 93 sieverts per hour. That's over 9,300 rem per hour. So if you wanted to get close, so the Russian scientists, they would go in there and look at it through periscopes and try to avoid looking at it directly. They would stick a camera on a stick and peek around the corner and take pictures of it so they didn't get fried from the radiation. The Three Mile Island meltdown in Pennsylvania was apparently an undiluted meltdown. So I'm estimating that the melted core, pure core, was about 1,000 sieverts per hour, which would be 100,000 rads per hour. So this is some information, a design spec. If you're going to build a robot to clean up radiation in Fukushima, the electronics are going to have to withstand 100,000 rads per hour, which is a pretty high radiation dose. T- typical radiation dose that for electronics is only like 500 to 1,000 rads per hour. That would cook your standard consumer electronics pretty well. The U.S. military developed radiation-hardened transducers and cameras and so forth that could take more than 1 million rads per hour, even up to 10 gigarads per hour. So you can build cameras, apparently, that can take up enormous radiation, that can still operate in enormous radiation fields. But if you had a robot where you're trying to actually go in and excavate and pull out cores, that's going to be an incredibly complicated system with thousands of components, and it's only going to be as strong as its weakest component. So every single component in the robot would have to withstand at least 100,000 rads per hour to have any hope at all of operating. As I said before, virtually all the information about Fukushima and the meltdown has been suppressed. The news media is not telling you very much of anything about what's going on over there. How many of you even knew about the Tomodachi sailors dying from radiation? One, two, three. So three of you knew about the Fukushima radiation killing a lot of U.S. sailors? Okay. On the internet, there are websites that are actually making it possible to find out what's actually going on over in Japan. And these websites, in many cases, are being suppressed by the Japanese government. There's now a secrecy law where you can be thrown in prison for 10 years if you reveal any state secret. And in Japan, the state secret is whatever they say a state secret is. So now, since I think last November, the secrecy law is in effect, and you can be thrown in prison for 10 years if you tell the truth about what's going on. So everybody who speaks over there speaks anonymously as much as they can. There have been people dying over there. There are a lot of stories about high school students dropping dead from heart attacks and other medical problems. And these are actually radiation-related, as you'll see as I explain when I talk about Chernobyl. Since the Fukushima information has been almost entirely suppressed by virtually every news media and government on this planet, we'll have to look at Chernobyl and get some information from Chernobyl as to what it does to people and what the consequences are. How many of you have read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring? One, two, three. Rachel Carson. That's a book you should read. That's one of the most important books that's ever been written in the last 50 years. Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. I'm not kidding. I'm not joking. I'm not exaggerating. That's one of the most important books that's ever been written. This book, Chernobyl, Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and the Environment, is probably one of the most important books that's been written in 150 years, and I'm not exaggerating. This is probably the most important book that's been written since Charles Darwin, Origin of the Species, was published 150 years ago. If you only read one book for the rest of your entire life, and I mean it, I'm not joking, if you only read one book for the rest of your life, this is the book you should read, Chernobyl, Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and the Environment. When Chernobyl melted down in 86, the Soviet Union suppressed all information about that as well. If you were a scientist and you published a paper revealing the truth about Chernobyl and what it was doing to people, you could be thrown in prison, or you could be killed, or you could just simply disappear and never be seen again. And so from 1986 to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, all the information about Chernobyl was suppressed completely, except for the fact that the Soviet Union reported that maybe 30 or 40 helicopter pilots died of cancer from radiation exposure. They told everybody, everything's fine. We got it under control. Don't worry. Be happy. It's all taken care of. And then after the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a brief window of time where the Russian scientists could actually report the truth, where they could actually write the truth, at least until Putin and the other dictators took power again. So there was a brief window of opportunity for just a few years for the Russian scientists to actually write scientific papers that actually revealed the true situation of what was going on over there. So this book is a compilation and a summary of that information from the Russian scientific papers. This book is a book you should read. You've got to get your hands on this book and read this book. I can't recommend it strongly enough. Let me give you an example. How many people do you think actually died from the radiation released at Chernobyl in the first 20 years? What's your guess? A couple hundred? Okay. Yes. Thousands? Keep going. Yes. Next? No. 5 million, you're too high, but not way too high. 4,000 is one of the numbers that the United Nations nuclear agencies was publicizing and saying that was the casualty count for Chernobyl. The Russian scientists, in their most careful calculations, estimated that slightly less than 1 million people died within the first 20 years from the radioactive fallout that was released at Chernobyl. That's almost 1 million people. Has any newspaper in this country told you about this? No. Is any television news program telling you about this? No. The radiation from Chernobyl covered the world. They found Chernobyl radiation fallout in Tahiti, in French Polynesia, on the opposite side of the Earth in the southern hemisphere. The radiation fallout from Chernobyl covered the Earth, but it primarily covered the Soviet Union and Europe. There's a lot of places in Europe that are still heavily dosed with radioactive fallout, such as radioactive cesium and strontium. This is just a tidbit of what is in this book. There's also another gift from Chernobyl, and also Fukushima has also put out this as well. They're called hot particles. How many of you have heard of hot particles? One, two. Only two of you have heard of hot particles? Okay. Well, the Russians first discovered it, and they called it Chernobyl dust. And basically, what it was solidified particles, only a few microns in diameter, just a few microns in diameter, but incredibly radioactive, incredibly radioactive. And the danger of the hot particles was if you breathe them into your lungs are getting an enormous amount of radiation, and you're going to get lung cancer and die from the hot particles. And I mention this because in Fukushima, there was hot particles emitted, and they actually came over to the United States, and they were measured in the United States in Seattle and Oregon. In Oregon and Washington State, there were air filters that were measuring hot particles. And it's estimated that the average person living in Seattle or Vancouver was breathing about 10 hot particles per day in the days after the explosion at Fukushima. How many of you knew about this? One person? Two people? Two of you? Only two people knew about this. The news media has not exactly been eager to tell you about this. But it's in Japan, they're also getting the hot particles. They found a hot particle in Nagoya, which I think is, what, 300 miles away from Fukushima? And in Nagoya, they found a hot particle that was putting out 400 becquerels. That's 400 disintegrations per second. It was part of one of the fuel cores that exploded, probably from Reactor 3. When Reactor 3 blew up, that was the most spectacular explosion. And that blasted a lot of plutonium and uranium into the atmosphere, which, by the way, was also measured in Latvia in the stratosphere a few days after the explosion of Reactor 3 at Fukushima. How many of you knew about that? None of you knew about that. I'm not kidding. There's scientific papers that have been published about plutonium that's been measured from the atmosphere that deposited in Latvia in the Baltics that crossed over the Pacific, the North American continent, and the Atlantic Ocean, and landed in the Baltics. But a lot of that also landed in the Pacific and also on North America as well. So there's actually a lot of radioactive fallout from Fukushima in North America right now. But again, the newspapers are not telling you about that. At any rate, the hot particles that they measured from Chernobyl were really pretty hefty. Some of them were putting out 10,000 becquerels of radiation. That's 10,000 disintegrations per second. So if you get that in your lungs, you're a dead duck. And if you have the smaller particles, like the ones that they found in Nagoya, those can go deep in your lungs and give you lung cancer as well. The scientists who were studying Chernobyl also found many other phenomena, which they only were able to publish after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Basically, they found that if you get exposed to a lot of radiation, it's the equivalent of accelerated aging. The radiation ages your cells very quickly, and that can cause an enormous amount of damage, such as heart attacks and strokes. So a lot of people who have been dying in Japan have actually been dying from heart attacks and perhaps strokes as well. Also, they found at Chernobyl, after they studied the Chernobyl radiation, that there was a lot of brain damage. A lot of the people who were actually involved in scooping up radioactive fallout material had brain damage. These people were called the liquidators, the Russian liquidators. They would go out and scoop up the radioactive fallout contaminated ground and put it in a safer place, presumably. But the radiation exposure would damage their brains. It would also give them cataracts, premature cataracts, and give them all kinds of medical problems, such as blood, heart, lung, gastrointestinal, bone, skin diseases, and everything imaginable, both young and old. So that's one of the reasons why so many people died in the Soviet Union. Another effect from radiation is the radioactive iodine. Your thyroid gland is very, very, very efficient at collecting iodine from your food source to use it to make the iodine hormones that the thyroid uses to regulate your body metabolism. And a lot of the children over in Fukushima are showing thyroid abnormalities. A very high percentage of them are showing abnormalities in their thyroids from a massive exposure to radioactive iodine from Fukushima. They saw it at Chernobyl, and they're seeing it now at Fukushima. And some of them are also showing the thyroid cancer. Also, your immune system gets wiped out from the radiation exposure as well. Your immune system is mainly based in your bone marrow. Your bone marrow is the source of probably about 95% of your immune system. And your bone marrow is very sensitive to radiation, because any cells that are replicating rapidly are very susceptible to radiation exposure. And your bone marrow most susceptible. And when you lose your bone marrow, you lose your immune system. And when you lose your immune system, you basically get death. You can't survive. If you don't have an immune system, you're cooked. And this was seen for the children at Chernobyl and adults as well, and also for the liquidators. So most of the people who were studied were showing high blood pressure. They were showing heart attacks. They were showing cerebrovascular diseases such as strokes and arteriosclerosis, of all things, which is something you would only think a very old person would have. But this was seen in many people, even young people. But the worst of all was the destruction of the immune system. That's called Chernobyl AIDS because it's so similar to AIDS. You know, and AIDS is the destruction of your T cells. The CD4 T cells are attacked by the AIDS virus. And when you lose those cells, your immune system is basically wiped out and you basically die from opportunistic infections from fungus or bacteria that normally your immune system would have no trouble fighting. So Chernobyl AIDS is one of the main things that the Russians discovered after Chernobyl. And let's see. They found that in many territories, not just in the Chernobyl itself, but in many territories that were exposed to very high levels of radioactive fallout, where the wind and the rain randomly deposited the radioactive cesium and strontium. Now that we get to another one, this was it's called Chernobyl Heart. This is from cesium-137 in particular. Cesium-137 is almost identical to your potassium, and your heart muscle and all your muscles use a lot of potassium. And if you're exposed to a lot of cesium-137, your body treats the cesium-137 as if it was potassium and puts it in your muscles. Your most important muscle is your heart muscle, because you're not going to live very long without a heart muscle. So they found Chernobyl heart. When they did autopsies on dead rats and also on children and other people who died suddenly from heart attacks, they found out that the radiation was in their muscles, in their heart, and that was damaging their muscle tissue, and they were getting heart attacks. And the scientist who discovered this was actually thrown in prison for 8 years after he published this. This was in the country of Belarus. I guess it used to be called White Russia, Belorussia. So the government didn't like this because he was telling the truth and they didn't want that. So they threw him in prison for 8 years and they sent the secret police to destroy his lab and all his papers. The European Union took 3 years to get him out of prison, and then after he was released after 3 years of effort from the European Union, then he published his papers about Chernobyl heart. And presumably he hasn't been assassinated yet. His name is Yuri Bandachevsky. He's a very brave man. I mean, how many people would dare to tell the truth if they spend 3 years in prison? So this actually happened, and this is actually a real phenomenon. Again, Chernobyl heart. How many people here knew about it before tonight? How many heard about Chernobyl heart? Nobody. So this is giving you an idea of how much information suppression is going on, not only about Chernobyl, but Fukushima especially. At any rate, if you get 50 becquerels per kilogram in your body of radioactive cesium, you're likely to have a heart attack, like the people in Japan are currently experiencing. Okay, so now we get to the point where a lot of people are saying, well, it's very bad. What happened in Japan is very, very bad. But we're okay over here in North America because the ocean is going to dilute all that radiation and we're going to be safe. So it's don't worry, be happy, go to the shopping mall and spend money and support the economy. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. There's an ocean current called the Kuroshio Current that carries ocean water straight from Japan to the United States, to the coast of Oregon and California in particular. It's called the Kuroshio Current. How many of you knew about the Kuroshio Current? Okay, many of you did. Good, good. So the Kuroshio Current. Kuroshio. Yes. At any rate, that's carrying the water straight to the west coast of the United States. And there has been a deposit of radioactive cesium and radioactive strontium in that ocean water. Radioactive strontium and radioactive cesium are the most dangerous because they're very soluble in water. They're extremely radioactive. They're absorbed by the human body very rapidly. And the nuclear fission process produces an enormous amount of it. Some of you were able to get the handout that I put out earlier today. So cesium and strontium are the two greatest threats. It's going to be bioaccumulated by organisms in the ocean, similar to what Rachel Carson described when she was talking about bioaccumulation of DDT in plants and animals, where you had DDT in the environment in parts per trillion, then it would get bioaccumulated and concentrated into parts per billion, then to parts per million, then parts per thousand, perhaps, in some body at top of the food chain. It's been known since the 1950s. I think the U.S. Navy did studies back in the 1950s that there was the same process going on for radioactive isotopes. And typically, you have a concentration of radioactive isotopes at every step of the food chain, from the phytoplankton to the zooplankton, and up and up and up through the food chain. But there's another way of looking at it, which is probably simpler and easier for calculation purposes, and it's called bioconcentration. Bioconcentration factors are basically what have been measured experimentally by U.S. scientists, like at the Savannah River nuclear site. And they define bioconcentration factor as basically the concentration of a radioactive isotope in units per gram or kilogram compared to the concentration of the isotope in the water or ground. And I give you some ranges for how much concentration there really is or can be in some creatures. This is based on freshwater fish because the Savannah River studies was all based on freshwater ecology in terms of plants and animals. So I presume the saltwater fish are going to be approximately the same in terms of their capabilities for bioconcentration. The bioconcentration range for cesium-137 in fish muscle, for a fish that eats other fish, for example, you could have a bioconcentration factor up to 48,000. In other words, if you had water, ocean water, which was like one becquerel. Actually, wait until after I finish the presentation. And oh, okay, yes. There's a request that the audience be more polite and not make so much noise so that other people can hear what I'm saying. At any rate, the bioconcentration factor for cesium-137 in fish ranges anywhere from 1,000 to 48,000 times. So if you had even just one becquerel per liter of water, which is a kilogram of water, you could theoretically have 48,000 becquerels of radioactive cesium per kilogram in the muscle tissue of a fish. If you stop and think about that, that should scare you a great deal. For strontium 90, the muscle tissue bioconcentration factor is 1 to 3400, which is not so bad. But the bioconcentration range for strontium 90 in fish bones is enormous. It can range from 51,000 to 63,000 times. So I would strongly suggest that you not eat any meat that's got any ground fish bones in it. And I don't know if they take, I've always wondered about fish sausages. Do they take the bones out before they grind up the meat or not? I'm wondering now about that. I hope they take the bones out before they grind up the fish and make sausages out of them. Plutonium is all over the map, but typical range for plutonium 38 in fish muscle bioconcentration factor is 2,600 to 12,000. So plutonium also gets bioconcentrated quite a bit too. But as I said, cesium-137 and strontium-90 are the real danger. That's the real threat. There's a lot more of it. Okay, so now hopefully by now you realize that we've got to develop some robot technology to take care of this problem. And I've got to go through this real quick. So we've got two choices. You've got to dig the cores out of the ground as much as possible, or else seal up the cores in the ground in an impermeable reservoir that keeps the water from leaking out into the ocean. To do this, we're going to need robots that are 1,000 times bigger and more powerful than the little toy robots that you see on TV today. I know that many people have put together a lot of robots, and there's a lot of impressive advances in robot technology in the last few years. But the kind of robots that are needed for cleaning up Fukushima are going to need to be about 1,000 times more powerful than anything that's available on Earth today. And they also should clean out the spent fuel rod pools as well, because there's an enormous amount of radiation in those spent fuel pools too. Okay, but as I said before, the radiation levels are astronomically high. The robots get fried. So what are we going to do about the robotic electronic control systems? How are we going to make them to survive in those kind of radiation fields? One solution, you could add tungsten or lead shielding. For example, you could use depleted uranium or lead or tungsten, and that would shield against gamma and X-ray radiation. That would be good for that radiation. But if you add beta particles, there's something called Bremsstrahlung radiation, which is basically the emission of X-ray photons when an electron comes to a dead stop suddenly. When it hits metal, it emits an X-ray called a Bremsstrahlung X-ray, which is a very high-power X-ray that's almost like gamma ray. So the best shielding against that is acrylic plastic, like plexiglass or lucite. That's one of the best shielding materials against beta particles. If there's any neutrons, the best shielding against neutrons is either going to be water, polyethylene, or concrete, something with a lot of hydrogen atoms. That would be your best shielding against neutron radiation. Okay, so you could have like three layers of shielding. You could have like 3 centimeters of tungsten or 5 centimeters of lead, and that would cut the gamma radiation dose by a factor of 10. But lead and tungsten are incredibly heavy. Most robots today couldn't lift that much shielding, even if that was all they had to lift. They wouldn't be able to lift the shielding alone, much less do anything else. And then you have to put some acrylic plastic or something else for shielding. So the robots can't do much with that. Okay, so next solution. How about using electronics less susceptible to radiation? Use IC chips like gallium arsenide or silicon on sapphire, or use special transistor architectures. There's special passivation layers you can put on top of the IC chips, or radiation covers based on copper tungsten alloys that would shield them from radiation. Or you could have guard rings around the structures of the transistors that which would drain away the leakage currents. So there's ways to design circuits to shield against radiation effects affecting transistors, but that may not be enough. Third solution, use what's called redundancy, triple module redundancy. That's a solution that's been used for some electronics, where you basically have three identical components, and then you have a voting system where you vote and say if three modules or two modules agree that something is true, then they're correct and they're working properly. Presumably, only one module will fail, but if you have two or three modules, if you do a voting, the majority rule wins, and presumably you'll get the right result and the right correct action from the module. But there's a limit to that, because redundancy actually amplifies failure if the failure rate gets very high. If the probability of failure is more than 50%, the redundancy actually backfires. Well, first let's take just a quick example. If the failure rate was only like 0.4% or 40%, then if you had triple module redundancy, basically you would get more reliability with a triple module redundancy if your failure rate was only 40%. So in that case, redundancy works. Suppose your failure rate is like 70%. The radiation's so bad, it's cooking the electronics. 70% of the electronic modules are failing. If you had triple module redundancy, for example, and did a voting majority rule wins, then the majority would lose because the majority would be wrong because the redundancy amplifies the failure. Okay. So the fourth solution, use some intelligent redundancy. And I'm suggesting an expert system to control redundant systems and double check the systems and perhaps get a higher reliability even in a high radiation environment. So that's the fourth solution, which I think is probably the more intelligent solution, but I don't know if anyone's going to adopt that. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up. Arne Gunnarsson is the first person to call this event at Fukushima what it really is, the greatest industrial disaster in history. He's not kidding, and he's right. He's absolutely right. The cores are going to have to come out of the ground, or they're going to have to be isolated. So far, all efforts have failed. TEPCO, the Tokyo Electronic Power Company, has failed in all efforts so far. So that's why they're going to have to send in robots. They're going to have to go dig out the cores somehow at enormous cost, and it's going to be incredibly difficult. But if they don't do it, then I've explained to you what happened after Chernobyl, and I've given you some clues as to what radiation is going to do to everybody if they don't get that radiation contained by getting those cores under control. And here's some outstanding websites I strongly recommend you go to. Fair Winds is Arne Gunnarsson's website. His discussions are very intelligent. He used to work in the nuclear industry until he was kicked out and blackballed, but he has an enormous technical knowledge. E&E News is also good. Informable is good. Helen Caldicott is an anti-nuke activist, and she has a website that has an enormous amount of good information as well. So I strongly recommend these websites for you. Very strongly recommend them. So that's basically it. Okay.
Our thanks to Kevin for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to The Ultimate Robot Challenge at Fukushima with Kevin Rowe. Now we open the floor to a Q&A. If you have any questions, we have a standing microphone back here, so please come back here and ask questions. And please make sure your questions are in fact statement and not a statement, but a question.
Two questions, actually. First, how did a patent attorney come to be interested in this kind of thing?
Okay, that's a good question. Actually, some of my relatives are in Japan. And I've actually also been involved in sending money and food packages to the people in the Tohoku area near Fukushima. So I feel very sorry for the people. Their suffering is much greater than what you're being told about. And also, some of my own relatives have been exposed to high radiation. One of them died from leukemia at a very early age, and one of my other family members developed cancer as a result of radiation exposure. So there's some personal connection to radiation and Fukushima, and also the physics of nuclear energy. My minor in college was physics. My major was electrical engineering, but my minor was physics, so I've been interested in nuclear technology for many years, too.
As I have also. The second, are you familiar with Santa Susana?
Santa Susana. Ah, yes. You're talking about that meltdown?
The local story, 6 out of 10 reactors melted down 20 miles from Los Angeles. And that was back in the late 50s. And at the time, they were licensed as commercial reactors. They melted down. Nobody knew and nobody cared back then, not because they were suppressing it, but because they were experimental. And it was the same place where they were testing all the big rocket engines that would take, you know, would develop into our space program.
Yes.
But 6 out of 10 reactors melted down. And when they started looking at it about 10 years ago, they found that all the paperwork for it was in the engineering library at UCLA, because the man who was in charge of General Atomics, the commercial company, was then promoted to become dean of engineering at UCLA. He took all his papers up there.
Yes.
But even to this day, it's a dirty site.
Yes, Santa Susana site, there's many people around that area who have developed many cancers. It was, that information is also not very widely known, but if you go on the internet, you can find out about the Santa Susana. Actually, in some cases, that was far worse than Three Mile Island. Far by maybe a factor of 400 times worse than Three Mile Island. But the newspapers didn't report it because this was back in 1959 or 58, I think, when the meltdown, actually there was like 3 different meltdowns at 3 different times, but the big one, the bad one, was in the late 50s, and that exposed a lot of people in Los Angeles to a lot of radioactive fallout that they didn't even know about until after they got cancer. So there's a lot of people in that area who have cancer as a result of the fallout from that meltdown. That's one of the best kept meltdown secrets in the world. Next question.
So is Helen Helicopter, she's the Australian woman?
Yes.
So I heard her speaking, she described how when they pull the rods out,
yes,
the rods touch each other.
There'll be an explosion, it'll be, you know, a million times worse.
Yeah, it could be a prompt moderated criticality. There's different kinds of criticalities you can have. You can have a super criticality like an atomic bomb explosion, but you can also have a prompt moderated criticality where you have too high a density of neutron production and it cascades. And that's actually what probably destroyed Reactor 3. Arne Gunderson shows some video on his website, which I strongly recommend if he still has it, if it hasn't been taken off, where he shows a prompt moderated criticality that was organized in, I think, the New Mexico desert by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission many years ago. And it's actually identical in the type of explosion to what was seen at Reactor 3 at Fukushima. So Arne was saying it was probably a prompt moderated criticality that boosted the energy level 1,000 times higher than what you saw at Reactor 1 and Reactor 2 when they exploded. Yes. Next question.
You said that the materials that they have to retrieve them and isolate them for thousands of years.
Yes.
Even if they manage to take the cores out, where do you think they would isolate them? Is there a place in the world that they have?
That's a good question. Japan wouldn't be a good place because Japan's covered with earthquake faults everywhere. There's an earthquake fault close to virtually every nuclear reactor in Japan. I mean, some of the nuclear reactors in Japan are right on top of active earthquake faults, and they're on the verge of restarting those reactors, which is suicide. But Japan is probably not a safe place. Nobody has really come up with a safe place to put the nuclear waste in New Mexico. WIPP, WIPP, they had a reactor. I mean, they had radiation released there just a few months ago that spread plutonium around the United States. So even the United States hasn't been able to figure out a good, safe place to put this stuff. So isolation might be the only choice. If they can't dig it out and put it in a safer place, they might just try to isolate it where it is in place. Next question.
So with all these issues, why don't we just forget the nuclear programs that are around the world?
Forget it? You mean stop them?
Yes.
There's an entrenched
economic interest. I mean, you have these power companies have invested tens of billions of dollars in these nuclear reactors, and if they shut them all down and just write it off as a total loss, that bankrupts the company. TEPCO, for example, they've got enormous amount of money invested in nuclear reactors all over Japan. If they shut down all the reactors, TEPCO goes bankrupt. So they've got every motivation in the world to keep those reactors going and try to restart them as soon as possible. Next question. Anybody
we'll take
else?
The last question here.
Okay.
So if we can't get rid of these nuclear reactors, what type of procedures would you suggest that we use instead?
If you can't get rid of them, in what way? What define what you mean by get rid of them?
If we can't just stop using nuclear energy, what type of procedures would we use in these plants to prevent future
Actually, there should be a gradual shutdown of these plants. There's over 20 boiling water reactors identical to Fukushima in the United States. Every one of those is a time bomb ready to explode when there's an earthquake that snaps the water pipes. So any one of those 20 boiling water reactors in the United States is capable of crippling this country and destroying its economy if it ever does a full meltdown like Chernobyl did. So the best thing to do would be a gradual shutdown year by year of the most dangerous reactors in a phased shutdown. You can't shut them all down all at one time because there's too much electricity that you need to replace. But those boiling water reactors in the United States need to be shut down immediately or in a phased shutdown mode gradually year by year. Those are the most dangerous reactors in the world. The boiling water reactors can be shut down later because they're less dangerous. Presumably less dangerous. But they're all dangerous because any earthquake, like magnitude 8, magnitude 9, will snap all the water pipes and destroy all the cooling systems. And if they lose their cooling systems, they all go into meltdown eventually, sooner or later. That's it, I guess.
Our thanks to Kevin for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 111th year of enlightening discussion, is adjourned.